You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. We're sponsored this week by Decode DC, the podcast that gives you an honest look into how politics affects your life. You got to hear this guy, Jimmy Williams. He's the host of Decode DC, and he's worked for Republicans, for Democrats. He's even been a lobbyist, and he's taking all that experience and explaining how things really work inside and outside of Washington. Decode DC is smart, often surprising, and challenges the conventional wisdom. Now, you know I'm a politics junkie, and I'm a big evangelist for podcasts. This one is one that I've been listening to for a while now, even before they became a sponsor. And one recent episode that I really enjoyed was all about moving day at the White House and what it's really like, told by someone who actually survived to tell about it. Did you know that when the presidency changes hands, just like it did a week ago, the White House only has 5 hours between the time the outgoing president leaves for the inauguration and the new president returns from the inaugural parade to get the old president and his entire family and their stuff moved out and the new one completely moved in? Fascinating stuff. There's even an ongoing series on how politics affects the food you eat, from salt to sugar and everything in between. So check it out. I'm a fan, and I think you'll really love this one. That's Decode DC, as in District of Columbia, available on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, enjoy this podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. My guest today has what he calls an unusual relationship with our new president, Donald Trump. Hugh Hewitt interviewed Donald Trump 15 times on his nationally syndicated show throughout the 2016 presidential campaign and participated as a panelist in 4 primary debates. Some of the exchanges between Trump and Hewitt have been friendlier than others, and several of them made national headlines as Hewitt quizzed Trump on world leaders, America's enemies, and matters like the nuclear triad. Now Hugh Hewitt draws on his personal experience with the president and his service to 2 previous Republican presidents in his new book called The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. Hugh Hewitt is a lawyer, law professor, and broadcast journalist whose nationally syndicated radio show is heard in more than 120 cities across the United States every weekday morning. Professor Hewitt is an analyst for NBC News and MSNBC, and he's a regular guest on Meet the Press, CNN, and Fox News. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including 2 New York Times bestsellers. He's a weekly columnist for The Washington Examiner and Townhall.com, and writes daily at HughHewitt.com. Before that, Hugh Hewitt served for nearly 6 years in the Reagan administration in a variety of posts, including assistant counsel in the White House and special assistant to 2 attorneys general. He's a graduate of Harvard College and the University of Michigan Law School, and he's taught constitutional law at Chapman University Law School since it opened in 1995. Today he comes on the podcast to talk about that unique relationship with President Donald Trump and propose what he calls a fourth way for the president, in cooperation with Congress and a united GOP, to lead us out of gridlock and the destructive political showdowns that have marred Washington for the past quarter century. He'll outline the key points of the Fourth Way and discuss how Abraham Lincoln and Alexander Hamilton implemented this particular mix of policies with great success in their days. He'll share his ideas for President Trump's infrastructure program and why he says Donald Trump should emulate Nixon in China when it comes to immigration. He'll discuss why he's opposed to overhauling the U.S. tax code and why he's for Trump's plan to build a 350-ship Navy. He'll also explain why the Fourth Way must be put into motion quickly, or Donald Trump could risk losing his congressional majority and even impeachment. Coming up with Conservative Radio's Hugh Hewitt in just a moment. It's been quite a year for Hugh Hewitt. He took over for Bill Bennett in the Salem Media Radio lineup, where he's syndicated to over 120 radio stations coast to coast. He also recently joined MSNBC and NBC as political analyst this past year. He's become a regular on Meet the Press. He made more than a few headlines sparring with Donald Trump during the 2016 election, including as a panelist in four presidential debates. He writes about his unusual relationship with Donald Trump and outlines his map for the Trump White House and Republicans in Congress in his new book called The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. Hugh Hewitt, thanks for sitting down with me.
Ben, good to be with you. Thank you for being interested in The Fourth Way enough to have a conversation about it.
Absolutely. Now, you've interviewed President Trump 15 times in the past election, plus you were a panelist on four debates. During one interview, you said, quote, "We have an unusual relationship, you and Donald Trump." How would you describe the current state of that relationship?
It's exactly as he responded in that interview in August, I believe, when I said, "You and I have an unusual relationship." He said, "It's fine. It's fine. I respect you. You do good work. It's fine." And that's not a direct quote, but that's pretty much what it is. And that's exactly what it is.
It's only fine. It's not terrific.
It's only fine. Yeah, I respect you is what matters more than anything in a broadcaster's career. Wasn't beautiful. Just fine. And it evolved from simply being Switzerland. I did 170 interviews with would-be Republican nominees.
And right.
Every one of them except the former governor of Virginia, Jim Gilmore, I did not interview. So I interviewed them many, many times. I interviewed President Trump, now President Trump, 15 times as candidate Trump, some before the nomination, some after the nomination. I would consider myself very supportive of him. I was very critical of him during the Judge Curiel episode,
right.
And he stopped. And those of us who were critical of him, I believe, saved his candidacy by being loud enough about that he realized, because he kind of tone deaf on issues of race. He's not a racist.
Yeah.
I don't believe it for a second. I don't think he's homophobic. I don't believe it. But he is indifferent to the language of race. And so when enough people say the same thing loudly, he hears it. And he doesn't necessarily say, "I'm sorry." In fact, he never says, "I'm sorry," proving that love story was wrong. He just stops, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
And then the second time was after the Access Hollywood tape came out, and
right.
Kind of shocking, and I called on him to withdraw from the race. He didn't. So then I supported him. I voted for him. And I campaigned for him all summer long, and I'm very glad he won. And we're talking after Judge Gorsuch was nominated. And if we go mm-hmm. back, Ben, to January of 16, when I was asked, would I support President Trump? I said, of course, I always support the Republican nominee. And the question was why? And I said, the Supreme Court's stupid. And mm-hmm. a lot of Trump doubters did not believe he would deliver on his promise.
Right.
But I had asked him that specifically on air. If you depart from your list of 21, will Leader McConnell be justified in filibustering you? To which he responded, I won't, and he would. So I've been comfortable with him since that moment forward.
Well, that's good, because I'm hoping that you can help me, because you know, as a Republican, I'm having a hard time here because I'm someone who would have been excited for probably any of the Republican nominees except Trump. There's a lot about this man that I find problematic on a personal level. And yet I really don't want to waste this unique opportunity that Republicans have. I'm just looking for some therapy here.
Okay, let me give it to you.
Walk me through.
As a Republican, had Hillary won and filled this court seat, a majority of the court would have been in favor of intervening in redistricting cases.
Right.
And the Republican Party would have been extinct by 2022. I believe that. And right. I believe that based upon Justice Breyer coming to my studio 5 years ago and saying his biggest regret was not getting into the redistricting case. He only has 4 votes to get into them. There's a bar on political question doctrine. I won't bore your listeners with it. I teach con law at the Fowler School of Law at Chapman University, and I always spend weeks trying to explain what redistricting law is. And, you know, the eyes glaze over in the students, and then nobody wants to hear about it. But the bottom line is if the court gets into redistricting, the Republican Party is dead because it will uphold redistricting plans like Massachusetts, where there are no Republicans, or New York, where there are few, or California, where there are few and falling. And they will strike down plans in Texas and in Pennsylvania and Florida, where Republicans have been favored, in Ohio, in the classic gerrymandering that has always been for political questions. So, number one, if Donald Trump hadn't have won, the future of the Republican Party would be academic because we wouldn't exist as a legislative party. Number two, he is going to build a 350-ship Navy. And
yeah,
the Navy has always brought the Republican Party together since the time of Reagan, and he's gonna build those ships, Ben.
Yeah. Now, I'm not going to do something as basic as ask you to give him a grade on his first week, but for you, what have been the biggest hits and misses of the nascent Trump administration in this first week or two?
In the first 2 weeks, I described it to Chuck Todd on air as you go to have a concert. I love to go to concerts. Most recently, I went to Jackson Browne. Of course, you know, way to the left of anything that I've ever believed, but he's a wonderful musician, a terrific lyricist, and a great performer. And in any concert, there are a few songs that are off. You wonder, where did that come from? And it's from the new album, and he's just trying it out for the first time, and you don't really like it. And so it's been a great concert. That's what I told Chuck, with a couple of bad playlists. Now, I've changed my analogy a little bit. Sometimes it seems like I walked into the battle of the bands with all 3 bands playing at the same time. And if you are my age, they used to have battle of the bands at high schools in the 70s and the 80s. And 3 bands would come and they'd play a set. And then you'd pick one. They get to come back the next week, et cetera. Well, sometimes it seems like the battle of the bands in the Trump administration with everybody talking at the same time. Mm-hmm. And therefore, messaging gets very difficult and hasn't been disciplined. I believe the worst part of the first 2 weeks was the rollout of the immigration pause and visa pause and refugee pause. It's not a ban. It's not a Muslim ban. But it was poorly rolled out. Mm-hmm. The high point was the nomination of Judge, soon-to-be Justice Gorsuch. And before that was the press conference with Theresa May, which was quite beautifully executed in both rollout and substance. So there have been a number of high points. There has been some bad messaging, but there has not yet been a terrible moment. There has not been a terrible moment. And so I don't mind the tweeting. I always tell people, watch what Donald Trump does, not what he says. His cabinet nominees, though we speak as Betsy DeVos is running into some headwinds, I believe all of them will be confirmed. And certainly they have far exceeded my expectation for conservatism. Scott Pruitt will be a terrific administrator of the EPA. General now Secretary Mattis, can't imagine anyone better for DOD. General now Secretary Kelly, can't imagine anyone better for DHS. Mike Pompeo is a friend of mine and is now running the Central Intelligence Agency as an Army Ranger and as a Harvard JD and just a successful businessman. I'm thrilled with his personnel selection. I'm not happy sometimes with the optics, but they'll learn. I mean, there's no honeymoon. This is the no honeymoon presidency.
Right. And one of the things that amazes me about this book is you're referencing appointees in the book. I mean, how quickly did you get this book published?
Story of the Fourth Way is interesting. I had put forward a proposal for publishers to consider in nascent outline form about how do we rebuild the Republican Party, expecting, as did everyone else, that Donald Trump was going to lose on election night. I was on NBC News that night. I slid my phone over to James Carville, who was talking to me when Chuck Todd and Lester Holt were talking to Savannah Guthrie, and I showed him the upshot on the New York Times when it went to Trump 70% potential, and, you know, kind of white as a ghost moment for James. Everybody in that building was surprised. I may have been the only person in the building to vote for Trump. I don't know that. Some people might have voted for Trump, but I'm happy to tell people I voted for Trump. It cost me $68 to vote for Trump, Ben. I had to send it overnight delivery because of the laws of California from New York. It has to be received within 3 days, and there was a weird thing about the – so it cost $68 to vote this year. And I was glad to do it, but if, like the NFL, I've used this line a lot, media had a concussion protocol, we'd all still be in it. Because we are still shocked and reeling from a wholly unexpected event. And I believe it's the only time I began doing presidential politics in 76 with Gerry Ford as a college student. And I've never not been involved except 84 when I was in the Reagan administration and the Hatch Act existed and we were not allowed to be political. So I've done every other race, either as a volunteer or a broadcaster. I guess I couldn't do 88 either because I was at OPM enforcing the Hatch Act. But I was deeply invested in George H.W. Bush winning. Mm-hmm. Often one or the other party is wrong, and often the media is surprised, but never before have all three been both wrong and surprised. Everyone expected, all three, Republicans, Democrats, and the media, expected Secretary Clinton to win, and they expected it would be easy and big. And she lost, and it wasn't close because the constitutional majority – and I take points off for anyone who brings up the popular vote because they cause AP history test takers to fail every time they talk about the popular vote. I'm sure some kid sits down there and they see popular vote matters and they say, oh, yeah, everyone talks about it. It must matter. No, doesn't matter, never has mattered, and it's never going to matter because the Electoral College is never going to go away because it requires two-thirds of each House of Congress to put forward an amendment and three-fourths of the states to confirm it, and the little states will never do it, so it's never going away. So get over it, America.
Well, neither party wants to finance a national election.
No, we don't. And by the way, you don't have to – you do this for a living. Republicans don't want to spend money in California. And we haven't got enough money to spend money in California. You're absolutely right. It's just never going to change. So I wish people would stop talking about it.
Well, you know, and one of the more interesting flashpoints of your quote-unquote unusual relationship with Donald Trump, there was the moment that most people are most familiar with when Donald Trump was struggling with some of the questions on foreign policy and national security. You asked him about General Soleimani, the nuclear triad, the Quds forces. I don't think that those were unreasonable questions to ask of a Republican presidential candidate. I tend to think that most of the other candidates would have gotten those right. He did say during the debate, if he were elected, he would, according to him, understand those issues and know those leaders and know those names better than anyone ever in the history of government. Do you think that's the case? Do you think he's, now that he's in the White House, he's a quick study on these things?
He's a very quick study. He's a developer. I've been working for developers my whole life, and that's what they do is they move project by project. They learn the parameters of the project. They establish a critical path, and they move forward. In the Kurds interview that you referenced, part of that was on me. You and I are sitting across from each other. And Kurds does sound like Kurds if you're on a phone connection. And I absolve him of the meandering that followed after that. He did not know Soleimani. And he said, but I will, on the first day in office, be as smart as anybody. And he brought along Mike Flynn. And Mike Flynn is as smart as anybody out there.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't like Mike Flynn. I like General Flynn a lot. I've sat down with him in green rooms. I've interviewed him on the air. I've read his book, Field of Fight. And he is very, in fact... he was the one who walked out and delivered a message to the Iranians, you're on notice. Mm-hmm. And Flynn and Mattis know Iran, and they know exactly who Soleimani is. They know where he is fighting right now. They know he was in Aleppo when he was directing Hezbollah and the Quds Force, expeditionary force, to assist Assad. They know everything about him. So Trump is getting what a developer would. Give me the bottom line on Iran, Mike. And he's going to say, Soleimani, bad guy, charismatic, incredibly talented. We've got to watch him and... this is the action we set forward. So he did, in fact, stand up the best foreign policy team that we have had, I believe, since the early response to 9/11. I thought that with the exception of Mr. Tenet, who did not fight against the wall between CIA and justice, that the Bush 43 national security team in the aftermath of 9/11 was top-notch. And George Tenet is a good man. It's just he didn't fight to take that wall down. I think this national security team is top-notch. Yeah. And so he stood it up.
before we delve into the idea of the fourth way of government that you outline in this book, that's kind of your template that you're proposing to the administration and Congress, I guess just for context, tell the listeners what were the first, second, and third ways.
Happy to, because the fourth way is, in fact, sequential. The first way is FDR's way. It's the It's the modern administrative state invented at the crisis of the Depression, where a number of administrative agencies were stood up. Progressivism was intellectually prior to the New Deal, but the New Deal put in place the agency structure that became the administrative state empowered by the crisis that was the New Deal. And that was embraced subsequently by Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Carter. They grew it all. Even Nixon and Ike grew it, and they kept making it bigger. In fact, Nixon, on the environmental side with the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, he unleashed upon the country a locust-like field of bureaucracy. And it grew and it grew, and it took on more of the state function, et cetera. The second way was Ronald Reagan's way, which was to roll back abroad the Soviet Empire and at home the regulatory state. He succeeded very well in the first, not so much in the second. He did put some pauses in place. He did cut back, but he didn't abolish any agencies, the Department of Education. The third way is actually a term coined by Tony Blair, Prime Minister of Great Britain, and appropriated by Bill Clinton to put a happy face on big government, to say, we're not big government anymore. We're really effective government, and the era of big government is over, to quote Bill Clinton. But they didn't really believe it. So the third way was actually what Barack Obama took and grew dramatically even more by calling it something that it wasn't, effective, efficient government. Yeah, no, it isn't. It's just massive, giant, $20 trillion deficit government. Mm-hmm. The fourth way is the merger of Reaganism with Donald Trump's ideas about the central government, which are actually Hamiltonian. I don't want to bore your listeners, but it's Hamilton.
Yeah, and that's interesting because you point out that this particular cocktail of policies you're proposing hasn't been applied since the age of Lincoln, and even then, not since Alexander Hamilton before him. What did Lincoln and Hamilton's versions of the fourth way look like?
Well, Lincoln, of course, was managing a civil war, so he had a huge federal apparatus in the field. But even as he did that, he believed in devolution of power to local authorities dramatically. The Homestead Act, which settled you know, tens of thousands of people on the land with very little administrative state. And he believed in internal improvements, the transcontinental railway.
Right, railroad.
And his only memorable speech as a congressman, he gave many memorable speeches as a candidate, including Cooper Union, but as a candidate, but as a congressman, was on the floor of the House calling for internal improvements. He wanted a lot of money spent on bridges, roads, and the 19th century equivalent of airports, canals, things like that. And today, Trump wants to do that. He wants a lot of infrastructure spending. And the fourth way is, okay, how do you do that without growing the government? Mm-hmm. I have some specific prescriptions based upon California's Prop 10, of which I've been a participant for 18 years. I served on a California State Commission based in Orange County, originally passed by Rob Reiner.
Yeah, I was surprised to see you praising, of all people, Rob Reiner, such a noted liberal. Prop 10 is something that you talk about as being a template for national infrastructure implementation. What is it that we're doing right in California that you think could be applied here?
When Prop 10 passed, it applied a 50-cent per pack of cigarette tax, which was then divided up 20% to the state, which is lost money. That's wasted money. And 80% went to the counties. And in the county, you got a check. So every year in Orange County, they get between $20 and $30 million, sometimes as much as $40 million. Here, spend it on this objective: to make children age 0 to 5, including the unborn, through 5, healthy and ready to learn by the time they begin school. That's the objective. You do what you want. Totally local control. So Orange County put together a board of 9 people, of which I've been one for 18 years. I went to my last meeting this week because I've moved to Virginia and I can't sit on a California commission as a Virginian.
Okay.
And so we have spent over that time about $500 million on whether it's dental clinics, autism clinics, swimming pools, child obesity clinic, you name it. We have done $500 million worth of infrastructure. And from that experience, I have very defined views that you don't want a lot of rules. You do want volunteers running it, people like me. You know, they pay me $100 a meeting. I lose money every time I leave the door for this doggone thing. And I'm under the ethics rules of California. So I haven't had anyone buy me lunch in 18 years because you can't under the Orange County has something called a cup of coffee law so that no one can buy me lunch. So for 18 years, no one's bought me lunch unless I can demonstrate reciprocity back and forth. And that's because they gave us the power to do what was right from my own backyard. And I know better than anyone. I've tested this out, Ben. If I go into any community in the United States and I say to them, I find some smart people, and they can be all dog catcher, doctors, lawyers, teachers, university professors, well, maybe not university professors, but normal people, business people, homemakers. What does your community need? They know. Mm-hmm. If you go to churches and synagogues, they know who actually runs the most effective homeless or the most effective pregnancy crisis counseling or the most effective drug intervention. They know, and they know what is needed. If you give them the money, they will build. And my second example came from Phoenix, Arizona, the Neighborhood Christian Clinic, wholly privately funded. But if you give them, and my number is $100 per person in the county, so that every American gets the same amount of help in their county, and you do it by county, and you do it by volunteer boards, infrastructure building, actual good things will happen across the country.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Hugh Hewitt when we come back in just a moment. So it's a new year now, and there's no better time to launch an online business or expand your online presence for your existing business, and GoDaddy.com wants to help. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures, helping their customers kick ass by giving them the tools, insights, and the people to transform their ideas and personal initiatives into success. GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small business and the largest domain registrar with over 62 million domain names under management and big savings over other registrars. Their award-winning 24/7 support will help build your online business and give you everything you need to get up and running. Whether you have a new idea or an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name, and GoDaddy is trusted by 13 million customers. That's more than any other registrar. And right now, my listeners can get a special discount on a GoDaddy domain if you just use my offer code KICK30 at checkout to get 30% off new purchases. That's GoDaddy.com and offer code KICK30 for 30% off. You don't have to spend a fortune on a domain. Just go to GoDaddy.com and type in the offer code KICK30 at checkout for 30% off and launch your online business today. And now, back to the podcast. The one thing that I take issue with is the type of infrastructure. My concern is that Trump is going to just create some kind of a bloated WPA-like apparatus that's going to just be building a bunch of shiny new post offices, and you're kind of the Robert Byrd of public swimming pools.
I am. I believe in public
swimming
pools.
You want a whole bunch of aquatic centers. You know, my concern here is that, you know, instead of these trophies and these brick and mortar projects, I feel that we need infrastructure that actually makes America competitive and brings back jobs, stuff that isn't necessarily quite so tangible, regional transportation projects that cross state boundaries, hardening the grid, faster, wider broadband internet. I mean, we're 26th in the world in terms of internet speed. These aren't the kind of things that Donald Trump can, you know, host a ribbon cutting for.
In the, I propose that the Congress give the president 1/10 of what it gave President Obama, of which I believe he will do 100 times as much. So they provided President Obama in 2009 with $850 billion. That was largely because of the economic panic, and they just flooded the world with money.
Right.
So I don't want to give $850 billion again. I want to give him $85 billion. And of that $85 billion, only about $25 billion goes to the locals. A lot of it goes to the Secretary of Transportation with near complete discretion to do those kinds of projects, port authorities, airplanes. Not sure about broadband. The private sector should be able to do broadband. I mean, they ought to be able to find money in broadband. The Federalist approach, the Hamiltonian approach, is what will not be done if we don't do it? Mm-hmm. And at the local level, we know no one builds a homeless shelter to make money. Nobody does.
Right.
There's no money in homelessness. And nobody builds an airport to make money because you can't get the capital ever to return. You got to, and no one has, fields an army, a Navy, a Marine Corps, and an Air Force. So you got to find what is not the market cannot deliver and then give it the money to deliver it in an effective, efficient way. So I don't think we actually disagree. I like some of your projects. Transportation hubs are good, but local people know where to build them.
Right. That's true. Yeah. That's true. That's
not
true.
Jerry Brown's Train to right. Nowhere, which is a right. jam down in the Central Valley that they yeah. don't want, that will never get built. It's right. a giant waste of money.
Well, yeah, and it is kind of annoying to me because California has given high-speed rail a bad name. I think,
yes, they have.
I think there are certain urban centers in America that probably could benefit from that if people could have a faster, farther commute
into
town. If
he had built that train from LAX to Sky Harbor in Arizona or mm-hmm. to Nevada to Las Vegas, yeah. I'd be all in favor of it. Yeah. People actually make that trip, and, yeah. and I've taken the high-speed rail in Japan. I know that it works mm-hmm. and that it provides an alternative.
Same here.
But to build it in the Central Valley is just stupid. Yeah. And that is a government imposition yeah. on what is, if you give that money to LA County and you say you've got to spend on transportation, yeah. they'll fix the port.
In here, you also propose giving $25 billion in infrastructure spending to representatives and senators to dole out in their states and districts, but only if they vote for the yes. overall infrastructure bill that you're proposing. Again, I'm not trying to play too much of a devil's advocate here, but it sounds a little bit like the spoil system. Isn't that what Trump's people voted against?
No, it is the spoil system.
Okay.
It's pork on steroids. And yeah. I want to be very clear about that. Jim Swift of the Weekly Standard asked me about this. I said, oh, it's log rolling. It's what we have been doing in this country forever, only we make it completely transparent with accountability.
Okay.
The
okay.
trouble with what happened with earmarks is that nobody knew where the money was going, and nobody knew who was directing it because it was being done by the appropriators or the cardinals mm-hmm. in secret. And there were a lot of people who didn't get even a share in their county if they didn't get an appropriations cardinal. So it set up a government within the government. It was very nefarious what earmarking did. I suppose the old school was, what do you want? Yeah. What do you want in your district,
right.
Ben? And, yeah. and put your name on it and cut the ribbon. And that actually produced, and I, you said a bad word about the WPA. I kind of like the WPA.
Yeah.
It's the only thing I liked out of the New Deal. The Civilian Conservation Corps, they didn't acquire any skills. And maybe they didn't starve, and they built some roads in the national parks, et cetera. But WPA, anyone who's listening can go with wherever they are in this country and find a WPA project.
Right.
They
That's
can't,
true.
And that is still there.
Yeah.
90 years later, or 1936, whatever it is, 80 years later, they can go and find it. And I write in the book, my first job was in a WPA pool at Waddell right. Park in Niles, Ohio. It's still there. The park's still there. I don't know if they're running the pool anymore. They ran it 3 years ago last time I checked, and so who knows what happens in 3 years. But it can be done. And if mm-hmm. we're going to spend money, and by the way, Trump campaigned on this. Mm-hmm. And I'm all
yes,
about,
he did.
I'm all yeah. about, he campaigned on the list of judges and he delivered. He campaigned on mm-hmm. a 350 ship Navy and he delivered. And he campaigned on this and he delivered. You know what he also campaigned on? Not reforming entitlements. That's
yeah.
a problem. Now, you know, the country can't afford, I have some statistics. The Social Security Disability Income Program has gone from 7 million participants to 14 million participants in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's unsustainable. It's already broke. In 3 years, it's broke. That means we're putting in more in SSDI deductions than we're paying out in benefits, more than we're taking in deductions, and so we have to cut the benefits or borrow money. And it's going to get bigger. Social Security is going to be bust. Medicare is already bust. Medicaid is a disaster. Paul Ryan should say, go big, go far, go fast, Mr. President. I'll give you everything you ask for, but you have to give me entitlement reform. Mm-hmm. We're the Article I Republicans. We're the Ronald Reagan, Paul Ryan Republicans, of which I am one, but I am willing to do the big deal. And this book is about the framework for the big deal. And by the way, it also includes the fence or the wall or the barrier, whatever you
right.
want to call it, because he campaigned on that and he won. And so he should build it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because you say Trump can do Nixon to China on immigration. What do you mean by that?
Nixon
and
was.
And you worked for Nixon. So
I did. I worked for
out.
Nixon as yeah. a young writer in San Clemente, the Elba of America, from 78 to 79. And then in 80, I went with him to New York City and continued to work on two books, The Real War and then Leaders. And then I left. I came back to work with him on the building of his library 10 years later after the Reagan administration. I knew RN, Richard Nixon, very well. And Nixon to China means when you build up credibility on an issue, to the extent that no one can say you are soft on it. So Nixon was an anti-communist, and, you know, discovered Hiss. He was a very strong vice president under Ike. He ran against Helen Gahagan Douglas in the infamous Pink Lady campaign of 1950 in the Senate annals. He was just an anti-communist. So when the anti-communist Richard Nixon says, hey, I'm going to China and we're going to normalize relations, no one can say you're soft on communism. Okay, Donald Trump ran on illegal immigration. He ran on the wall. He's going to build the wall. When he just says, this is the immigration solution that we are going to adopt, and I have my own suggestions on regularization. I don't believe anyone who enters the country legally should ever vote unless they return to their country of origin and come in legally. But I do believe in regularizing people, shelter in place.
Yeah.
Come into the economy. You're not going to be eligible for the benefits package. You will be eligible for education. You will be eligible for driver's license. You're going to pay taxes. You're going to do everything else. It is a second class of it's not citizenship. It's a second class of status. It's a green card.
They can't
status.
Vote.
They can't vote.
Right.
But their children are citizens, and I don't want to send anybody home who isn't a bad person. You know, and we can find bad people pretty well, especially when you ask people to come above ground.
Yeah.
Those who come up and regularize and say, "Hello, my name is Joe, and I've been working at the supermarket for 25 years, and here are all my bills." The local board says, "Purple card. Here you go."
Yeah.
And after 1 year of this, we're down to the people who won't ask for regularization. Very easy to find them.
Yeah. Well, you know, the problem is Nixon didn't go to China and say, we're going to build a great wall of our own and you're going to pay for it. It's going to come out of my pocket, isn't it? Can we just say that, or can he just say that?
I personally believe that what we will end up doing is taxing the remittance.
Okay.
And so it's not going to be Mexico paying for it. It's going to be Mexican expats paying for it. That's what I think is going to happen.
When if I could imagine any other country coming to the U.S. and saying, we're going to make you a sovereign nation pay for our infrastructure project.
Yeah. The only way is by remittances of Mexican expats. I don't believe a border tax is, by the way, making them pay it. That makes me pay for it.
Yeah.
Directly as a consumer. And so that doesn't make any sense to me either.
Well, yeah. And if it's going to come out of my pockets, it better not be some bloated, useless boondoggle walled to nowhere that doesn't do what it sets out to accomplish. I feel that your idea of a wall, which you can describe for me, is probably better than what I imagined the wall would look like.
Well, I have crossed the Mexico-United States border many, many times. My church supports an orphanage down in Tijuana. So I've gone over the San Diego crossing and even the Otay Mesa crossing many, many times. And people know what that's like. And they have a long, strong, double-sided fence. All right, it is a wall at some point, but mostly I'm thinking, and I always put up the picture of this remarkable fence. I think it's in Arizona, where you've got a Border Patrol car running along between two lines of fence, and they probably put it at a high crossing place, because I always hear, if you build a 20-foot fence, they'll bring a 21-foot ladder. Well, in fact, they won't bring a 21-foot ladder across the desert, but even if they do, they're not going to be able to get over the first fence and then over the second fence before you patrol it. We built the interstate highway system. I am tired of people telling me we cannot build a secure border, because if you can put the 70 through Eisenhower Tunnel, you can build, it's a 2,000-mile border. About half of it's impassable, so I am told, mountainous, rocky lakes that you can't swim, things like that. You need about 850 to 1,000 miles of double-sided, long, strong, tall fencing with a Border Patrol accessible vehicle path between it, and we will end not all illegal immigration. There will be tunnels. Half of our illegal immigrants are visa overstays. People will enter via the ports. But we will secure the southern border. Again, that's a national security issue, because we're not the only people in the world that know that it leaks like a sieve. Mm-hmm. Bad people, not economic migrants, but terrorists know that it leaks like a sieve as well, as do gangs.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk very briefly about economics. You have your plan to juice the economy. On the corporate side, you echo Trump's call for a repatriation holiday. But on the personal income tax, you say that you're not too big of a fan of these grandiose tax overhauls like the fair tax.
I hate the fair tax. I wrote a separate book called The Fair Tax Fantasy. primarily, theorists do not live where people live, which is in their homes. And they love the home mortgage interest deduction. And if you take it away, the Republicans will get wiped out. And they do not live in theory. They live in New York and California, which are high tax states. In fact, they live in Pennsylvania, which is a pretty high tax state. It has an income tax. Wisconsin's got an income tax. These are states that voted for Trump. If you take away the deductibility of state and local income taxes, you crush the Republicans and you lose the House majority in those states. I'm very political about this. And they love their churches, their synagogues, their mosques, their temples, and they love their hospitals and their colleges and universities, and they write big checks, and the community needs the tax deduction for charitable deduction to be unlimited. So I don't like the Hayekian theorists who say we need one rate or two rates and no deduction. No, we don't. The 1986 tax code simplification, which I was present at the creation for in the Reagan administration, I'm not a tax guy, but I was there, left those deductions because they had enormous political valiance, and they were incredibly important. I don't want to tilt at the windmill. I don't want to go try what my appendix in the fourth way puts out is a senior partner at Deloitte, now retired, Hank Adler, wrote for me how you can simplify tax forms so that people can do them without assistance of professional. They want simplicity. That's all. And for rules to stay rules and stay set. And if they pull the rug out from underneath homeowners, we will justifiably be crushed at the polls.
And you say that the president and Congress will have to implement these plans quickly or they're going to fail. What's the urgency? Midterms?
Yes. Okay. You have to put results on the table by 2018 because he's going to be judged on it. Ronald Reagan got slaughtered in 1982. Slaughtered. Right. I was there for that as well. George W. Bush did not get slaughtered in 2002 because it was a year and 2 months after 9/11. It was a national security election. That's not going to happen, I hope, I pray, in 2018. We're going to have a regular off year where the party in power gets hammered if they haven't done what they said they would do. Mm-hmm. So go big, go far, go fast. The need is for speed, not Washington standard business as usual.
And the worst case scenario here is you bring up the specter of impeachment toward the end of the book. That was a little surprising for me.
Well, I'm a law professor.
To come from you, but
I'm a law professor.
Do you think that's a real possibility?
Yeah, David Brooks said it would happen in the first year. I don't believe that.
Right.
I believe it will happen only if the Democrats take control of the Congress. They are already laying the groundwork for it by claiming that he is in violation of the Emoluments Clause, which I do not believe is the case. A lot of commentators are trying to use the word obsess 15 times every time they appear on television in order to create suspicion about his capacity to govern. I can see it all happening, but they need the House to make it happen. Now, Republicans have actually impeached one of their own, and they would have convicted Richard Nixon. Democrats refused to convict one of their own and with Bill Clinton, and they didn't convict Andrew Johnson either in 1868, whatever year that was. And so Republicans will do what is, if there is genuine corruption or genuine abuse of power, and I don't think there's going to be, but if there was, they would do that. Democrats will impeach for political purposes, and they're already laying the groundwork. So we have to hang on to the Congress.
Do you think there are some Republicans in the Senate and Congress who wouldn't shed a tear if Mike Pence were the president?
They would, but they'd also realize that if you impeach, Mike Pence would be removed in a landslide to follow. The 1974 and 76 elections following the Nixon resignation were nightmares. And Republicans mostly want to get reelected, so they're not in any hurry for an impeachment.
Yeah. As someone who worked with Nixon, do you have any advice for him on avoiding impeachment?
Loyalty is great. Hyper-loyalty is dangerous. You want people – blind loyalty is fatal.
Yeah.
And Richard Nixon did not have time to patrol G. Gordon Liddy, a good man in his radio career, but too enthusiastic for the reelection of the president, or James McCord. And in fact, there were a bunch of people. John Dean was weak. G. Gordon Liddy was ambitious for the president's service. Chuck Colson was out of control. This is before his conversion. Blindly loyal, energetic people are dangerous. I'll conclude, if I can, Ben, with the German general staff before World War I had a four-square box. Energetic or lazy, smart or stupid. And they said, okay, the stupid, lazy people, you need them in the Army. They can be the quartermaster supply sergeant. They're fine. Yeah. And the energetic, smart people, they become the colonels and the staff officers. They get it done. You make the smart, lazy people your generals because they sit back and they think and they worry about it. This is not General Mattis, obviously, but it's their German general staff. But you must get rid of the energetic, stupid people. You've got to get them out. And so in this case, you've got to get rid of the energetic, ethically gray people. And I don't know who they are, but you've got to be on watch for them or they will bring you down.
Yeah. Real quick, what was Nixon like? I always feel like he's like Charles Foster Kane. Everyone has a different version of him.
That's very well put. He was my best boss I've ever had.
Really?
I spent hundreds of hours with him. Extraordinarily bright, always reading, always probing, The most fun with Richard Nixon is when he would invite 8 people for dinner and go around the table and ask questions and conduct conversations. And he's the only guy I could see that could, and I saw him do it many times, deliver an hour speech without notes that he would had worked on beforehand. Very, very carefully. He knew exactly
without notes.
And he would stand with his hands in front of him. Many people saw this performance. He'd give you a tour of the world. And so I just loved the man. He was very, very good to me. But I came after the fall, which is a different Nixon than most Nixons know. And and when you, as Kissinger said in his eulogy of Nixon, when you stand on a pinnacle that becomes a precipice, it changes you. So I knew a very different Nixon than other people knew.
Yeah. Well, the new book is called The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. Hugh Hewitt, thanks so much for sitting down with
me. Ben, my pleasure. Good luck. Great podcast. You're doing the Lord's work.
I appreciate it. Thanks again to Hugh Hewitt for joining me on the podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, then you can order his new book, The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting Majority, on Amazon. Or you can download the audio version of his book for free through a special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. The Hugh Hewitt Show airs 5 mornings a week and is syndicated on the Salem Radio Network. You can find your local station or download the Hugh Hewitt app at hughhewitt.com. And follow Hugh Hewitt on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Don't forget to take our listener survey so we can keep the show free and find advertisers who are best matched to you, our listeners. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register for that $100 Amazon gift card giveaway. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can like Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews or click on the donate button at KickAssNews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.